Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Core Intuition, the iPad Super Episode.
What have you been up to since our last podcast about 3 years ago?
I have been just playing with the iPad for the last 2 weeks. That's all I've been doing. My Mac is shut down. I'm recording this off the iPad.
Yeah, right.
I'm just reading Twitter all day.
You lie! Yeah, I wish I could play with the iPad more. I have one. I got one on day one. Went out with my kid to the local Cambridge Side mall, and I picked up my iPad. Luckily, it only took about 5 minutes because it was like the underattended store in Boston, you know, because we have a big one downtown, and then this is like a little Cambridge, little side annex one.
Cool.
I've been excited about the iPad, but as you know, and as some of our listeners know, I am sort of like on a self-discipline, no iPad development until I reach a certain milestone with another of my apps. So I want to finish something I've been working on for the Mac, and then boy, watch out. It's going to be like a Carolina Twister.
Awesome. Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm not nearly that disciplined. I was working really hard on a new version of Clipstart, major new version, for like a couple months straight. And then the iPad hit like 2 weeks before the iPad shipped. And I was just like completely distracted, and I forced myself to get a private beta out to a few people so I could get some feedback. And then I just got sucked into iPad land for the last few weeks. So it's been a lot of fun, but man, I wish I had taken a little bit more time to wrap up some Mac stuff first.
Well, you have didn't your day job sort of prescribe you to work on some iPad stuff?
Yeah. Well, I volunteered.
Of course you did. Well, hey, there's nothing wrong with that. Doesn't that take you off of doing JavaScript on the web or something? I mean,
yeah, sort of. I mean, it's funny because I originally joined the company to do Mac stuff, and then I sort of got a little bit burned out, and I was doing all my indie Mac stuff, and so I switched over to doing web stuff. But yeah, but lately I'm back doing iPhone and iPad stuff, and I ported one of our iPhone apps I didn't work on. I made it universal for the iPad, and that was fun. And then I'm working on my own iPad app. I've been sucked into that a lot.
Yeah, so you've been working day and night on iPad stuff, huh?
Yeah, which has been fun. I mean, it's, you know, it's a fresh platform. It's interesting. And the funny thing is, I thought I knew how to build iPhone apps because I, you know, tinkered with a couple experiments last year. But man, there's a lot to catch up on, actually. I'm way behind the curve compared to everyone that's been shipping iPhone stuff for a year or two now.
Yeah, I'm going to definitely need some catch-up time, too. I kind of look forward to really getting to dive into that because I remember when I did a little bit of iPhone development when the SDK first came out and here and there over the past year. But I kept running into these situations where I thought, oh, this is going to be a real opportunity to, you know, build some infrastructure for the phone, you know, situations where it was clear that Apple hasn't really fleshed out the API in a particular way, and where I'm almost kind of like excited to have the opportunity to do some streamlining of the classes. And, you know, there's always more work to do in that regard, but on the Mac, I've kind of got a nice little set of conveniences that I've built up over the years, and on the phone and on the pad, I'll be able to use some of that stuff, but there's a lot of new stuff, especially when it comes to like how do you organize the view controllers, and you know, now with the new popovers and stuff like that, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of really cool little conveniences that you can write once and reuse. So I don't know, I kind of get excited about that, I guess, because it's like an opportunity to set yourself up for differentiation in the market with your own sort of clever hacks. And that's always kind of fun.
Cool. Well, keep it the Mac stuff, ship it.
Yeah.
And then you can come over to distracted iPad and iPhone land.
did you see the Guy Kawasaki post about,
no,
he contemplated what if the iPad had been what what we were familiar with all these years as a portable computer. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, 2 weeks ago on Saturday, Apple had introduced for the first time ever to the world the concept of the laptop.
Right.
And it was like, it was pretty clever. It was a lot of like fake press quotes, including
Walt Mossberg
saying, quote, iPad killer? It could be, you know? And it's like,
that's great.
It's like, if you just switch your perspective a little bit, it's like, what if there was a computer that was like an iPad, only it had a keyboard attached to it that could fold up, you could put it in your backpack, you could take it with you anywhere and type as if you were on a full-fledged desktop computer.
Yeah.
And what if there was an OS that had multiple windows that you could move around, organize however you want?
Yeah. Oh, man, that's a good point, though. I mean, just to put it in perspective, because, I mean, the sort of narrative lately has been like the Mac's days are numbered, and you know, eventually everything is going to be touch and everything's going to be like the iPad.
Yeah,
just because we've seen a peek at the potential for a large touch display device. But yeah, it could be totally wrong.
Yeah, it could be totally wrong. I don't think it is. I think what it is as usual, it's partly right, partly wrong for whatever, whatever application, whatever deployment scenario you have. So
right.
I was actually talking with he's from Austin, I think. You know him, Mike McCracken. Yeah. So I was talking with him about this you know, he had this post about the desktop, whether the workstation is dying, and I was sort of chatting with him offline about that, and it occurred to me, like, my thoughts on the matter, I'll probably write about this eventually, but it just occurred to me, like, people always want to jump to the conclusion, is one thing going to obsolete another thing? And things in real life never work that way.
Yeah.
You know, like the television did not obsolete radio. It didn't work that way.
Right.
It, radio became bigger and bigger and bigger until in my childhood, during the 80s, TV had been around for 30, 40 years. And radio was a huge part of my childhood, probably yours too.
Yeah.
So you think about this and you think, okay, what happened to radio is it changed, I'm sure. You know, it became less about conveying like dramatic radio plays and things like that. It focused on what it could do uniquely better than television.
Exactly.
And so the same thing's going to happen, I think. And it, sort of talking to Mike, it sort of started to gel in my head, like, this whole notion that the iPad is going to obsolete desktops is just a variation on the argument that the web is going to obsolete the desktop. And it's because it offers something tangibly superior, just as the web offers tangible superior elements to a pure, you know, anchored desktop experience. But, you know, it's just going to give us the clarity to try to figure out what is the desktop good for, and at the same time, it's gonna take from the desktop is going to take from the web whatever is good about the web. It's going to take from the iPad, I believe, eventually, whatever is good about the iPad, and you know, the web, the iPad, and the desktop are going to sort of, you know, they're gonna have their tentacles like creeping towards one another until they all integrate into, you know, platforms that really serve their market the best they can with the benefits of all three.
And I agree with what you were saying earlier too. It's an opportunity for each platform to focus on what it does really well. We asked people on Twitter to send in some questions. Actually, I'm looking at the list, and Michael McCracken was one of the people who sent one in. So he asked kind of the same thing you were talking about with him privately. He says, what do you do with a desktop laptop that an iPad-like device can't replace, assuming a hardware keyboard? So specifically, I've been thinking about that same thing when I first got the iPad. Like, what could I move to the iPad to allow me to focus more on the Mac, and sort of, you know, what could I only do on the Mac versus what I could offload to the iPad? And as an experiment, I tried doing Twitter exclusively on the iPad, news with NetNewsWire, exclusively on the iPad, some web stuff. Both those things worked out great. I also tried moving chat, some chat stuff, so AIM and Campfire. Those didn't work out so well. The lack of background apps that can keep running and doing chat stuff sort of kills that a little bit. And also, it was like the best iPhone native app for Campfire, which is 37 Signals' chat thing, which I use with work folks. They haven't updated it for the iPad yet, and I'm not sure they're going to, which is kind of strange.
Hmm.
So the web, they were thinking that the web version would be good enough on the iPad.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, when the iPad shipped, I guess no one at 37 Signals would test in the simulator yet, which not too surprising. I think most web people probably did not make a habit out of that until they got the device, but it was broken for a few days. And so that was kind of a failed experiment, but I have been able to do Twitterific news, you know, web stuff. A lot of that I've been able to do exclusively on the iPad, but there's some stuff that it's just not possible. I mean, you're always going to want Xcode on your Mac, IRC and iChat and that kind of thing still makes sense when you can have it running in the background.
Yeah. For me, the big thing is I'm an extremely fast typist, and therefore I value a physical keyboard probably more than somebody who is not such a fast typist. So I can see some people who they don't consider like blazing typing to be part of their kind of workflow, to get along better with an iPad as a standalone replacement for some of those productivity things like mail. To me, when I'm on my iPad, I love using it for monitoring my mail and monitoring Twitter stuff. But frankly, I'm disinclined to write on the iPad because I feel like it's, you know, frustrating to me to sit there and peck it out, and then inevitably I'll make typos that I wouldn't make on a physical keyboard.
Sure.
Is an external keyboard on the iPad a solution? Not really for me, because the value of the iPad is its sort of two-dimensionality. You know, it's like this thing I can just leave lying around. You know, for me, my workflow has been, it stays in my living room pretty much, and it's there when I want to check something during a commercial break, if we're watching TV, or if I want to, my kid's playing and he's distracted, I'll be able to grab it and just do a little Wikipedia surfing or something. You know, I've been using that Sophie Touchler's, I think it's called Articles.
Yeah.
Pretty nice. So far for me, it really has been more of a consumption device. I think because, as I said, that keyboard thing is a big mental block. It's the same problem on the iPhone. I will not hunker down and compose a large, thoughtful tweet with a link, say, on the iPhone. It's something I'll try to remember to do when I get home and do it on a real keyboard. So I don't know how that's going to play out. Maybe they can eventually make typing faster. my thoughts when I use the iPad keyboard, I think this is visually it has better visual affordances than it does. You know, if you put your fingers down on the iPad, I think like keys arranged in an arc would be more natural for typing. And maybe that's true on a physical keyboard as well. I don't know why it is that I keep finding myself having to sort of contort to reach the right keys on the iPad. And I can imagine that there is a better layout for keys that sort of matches where the arc of your fingers naturally fall. Something like that might make it easier for me to type, but I can appreciate that it would be an aesthetic compromise.
Yeah, I've found it very difficult to adjust to typing on the iPad. I'm much better at it now than I was 2 weeks ago, but I'm still not sure I can type faster on the iPad than I can on the iPhone.
Yeah,
with thumb typing. I use on the iPad, I sort of use forefinger. Like I don't use my pinkies because they'd sort of get in the way, which is weird. I mean, it's completely different than typing on the phone. It's obviously completely different than a real keyboard. But I agree with you. I've yet to connect a real keyboard to my iPad. That defeats the purpose to me.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I don't know. We'll see. I think there's also an opportunity for apps on the iPad that sort of introduce workflows that make that problem you just mentioned of tweeting something with links and maybe referencing other people and that kind of thing make that easier. So I can see a real need for sort of scratchpad type apps or features in apps where you can sort of compose things together in one app without having to, because you don't have the things that you have on the Mac where you can drag stuff around and sort of copy and paste from different places easily from different apps. So on the iPad, I think you want inside some apps, writing apps and apps where you compose things. I think you need more features to help you. I want this URL and I want it here and I want this person's name and here and I want this clip of, right, you know, the snippet of text and that kind of thing. We're not seeing that yet, but I definitely run into that when I'm tweeting on the iPad. If it's anything more than just some stupid comment, when I want to include anything else or I want to check a reference or something, it becomes a challenge.
You know, it occurred to me just talking about how my major class of work hang up with the iPad is the keyboard. I can easily see this being a growing pain. Like, you know, our technology is moving at a pace and speech recognition is already good enough. I think that if Apple had, you know, incorporated speech recognition along the lines of what like the Dragon dictation stuff does, then I might very well be able to do things like Twitter and email on the iPad just by speech recognition. So one of the things that's going on here is Apple might be setting themselves up for, you know, right now for me, I don't feel like speech is a reasonable alternative to the keyboard. I don't know why that is. I haven't tried it recently, but I can imagine within the next few or several years, it being the situation where I'm comfortable with using speech on an iPad as my primary means of input, you know?
Yeah.
So it could be it's a case of Apple just obsoleting one of the input methods before we're quite ready for prime time, you know?
That makes sense. Shall we take another question? We've got a few other ones. This one's kind of technical. This one's from Jorge Ortez. SDK 3.2 and Target 3.0 makes sense. And UI idiom in OS less than 3.2. If you are, I mean, really, he's talking about a universal app, building a universal app that works on iPhone and the iPad. And what there's a couple things you can do. What I ended up doing, I was kind of short on time, and I ended up using 3.2 as the base SDK, and then sort of weak linking all of UI kit in, and then at runtime, you know, checking, you know, is UI popover controller available, and if so, do this, otherwise do this, something slightly different. That's fine. You can also use a lower base SDK and then, you know, do more runtime checks where, you know, you use NS class from string and those sort of methods, functions for figuring out what you need to do. But it makes it a little more tricky because you can't use the classes directly. You can't subclass them easily. You're using like ID in more places to make everything kind of generic and compile. But there's a couple choices there. I think it just depends on your app. I thought actually that most apps would be easier to make universal than they end up being. Not from a technical standpoint, but just from the UI. Like some apps, you just throw them in a split view and you add a popover controller here or there and you're fine. But there's a lot of apps that when you put them on the big screen, they just don't work well at all. They don't look right. And I'm not talking about pixel doubled. I'm, you know, taking into account the layout changes and the resizing, it still doesn't feel right. And so I think that was one thing that surprised me the most. You have this big screen. It's a great opportunity to build like real applications like we're used to on the Mac, but it definitely takes more thought into how you're doing things. And I think I can appreciate why more developers early on at launch day did like iPad only apps and kind of skipped the whole issue of how do you make one UI that sort of fits on both devices.
Yeah. So I'm not too familiar with that yet, 'cause I haven't, as I said, dived into the development too much. Is that a situation where when you make it's a different processor, right? So do you make literally multiple architectures when you're building that way?
Yeah, I believe it's a fat binary, right, kind of like you would have on the Mac.
So ultimately you have total control over the experience being different or the same. I mean, if you chose to, you could make a fat binary that played Pac-Man in the iPhone and Donkey Kong in the iPad.
Right.
So it's kind of an organizational thing, similar to the same problems we faced when we were deciding how to build for Intel and PowerPC at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that some of the same tricks in Xcode apply here, where you can define even a different SDK for each part of the binary. So I agree with you, Manton. It sounds like what you were saying is basically if you're sort of like adventures into the newer SDK are minimal enough, it might be easier just to build with the old SDK and dynamically look up stuff. Raises a question in my mind in light of the recent hoopla about the change in terms of the App Store, the SDK thing, where they said you have to use Apple's tools to develop and deploy your app. It makes me wonder, let's just say that whatever trick they use to confirm that it's using Apple's tools correctly only worked if you were using the 3.2 SDK, then you might run into a situation where using an older SDK and just dynamically knowing what's best for 3.2 might not get you where you want to be. Sort of speculation, I guess.
Yeah, no one knows exactly how that's going to work, I guess, in terms of rejecting
certain
classes of apps.
I have to imagine they probably wouldn't reject. They probably find a way that will allow older SDKs to still be accepted, but who knows? Do they sometimes require the latest SDK to be accepted into the store?
I don't think so. Well, I think they definitely encouraged everyone to make sure their app, when 3.0 came out,
right?
You know, they tested everything under 2 and 3, and they had a like sort of little tag in the store,
right,
saying it was compatible. And there was some confusion before the iPad launch. The documentation was worded in a weird way that implied you had to require 3.1.3 for a universal app.
Mm.
And I know Marco Instant Paper ran into this where I misread it as well. So, I mean, it's not his fault that he misread it, but he was originally requiring 3.0 and then he thought he had to require 3.1.3. And then all of a sudden he shipped his universal app and a bunch of customers, you know, upgrade, and then it doesn't work on their phone anymore because they're still in 3.0. So there was definitely some confusion there, but as far as I know, there's nothing stopping you from building against an older SDK.
Okay.
Right now.
Well, there's this other question from, I'm looking at shorthand Twitter account names here, but I think it's Michael Brewer.
Yeah.
And this is kind of interesting in light of what I was saying about not jumping in yet. He says, I worry that some influential Mac devs are spending too long on the sidelines. Isn't it better to get involved and make it better? I would say yes, but I also fear for what happens to the Mac if everybody just sort of ditches it and lets it, lets it sort of fester and not grow in the ways that we expect it to. So it's definitely a balance. It's a problem. The people who come to my mind are, for example, companies like Rogue Amoeba, who have sort of ventured into the touch platform but been scared away by policies from Apple, or maybe not scared, scared's not the right word, but
not willing to accept.
Yeah, chosen to not play in that sandbox. And then other companies I respect a lot, like Panic, who I imagine when and if they come out with some touch stuff, they're just going to really rock it.
Coda on the iPad would be phenomenal.
You got to think they have to be working on that. And I remember on iPad launch day, Cable got his picture taken in for like a Portland newspaper, I think, and showed him buying like what, 12, 15 iPads or something.
Right.
And that's not something that, the founder of a company does if they're just playing around with iPads. I think they probably have something up their sleeves. I think most Mac developers who haven't gone on to the platform yet are eyeing it and thinking, I got to get on there. It's awesome. But is it going to really hurt things if we wait, if we're patient? I don't I don't really think so, because a lot of this stuff we can only do it better in with the benefit of hindsight about what's worked so far and what hasn't worked so far. I'm excited to get onto the iPad. I'm excited to get onto the phone. But to be honest with you, every month that passes, I get to witness other people's mistakes. I get to witness Apple remedying its own mistakes. If I come out with an app today, for example, I'm not going to suffer from, you know, some of the early rating problems that they had where anybody could rate an app. Mm-hmm. If I come out with an app for iPhone OS 4, then I won't have to suffer the rate on quit or what is it, rate on delete problems.
Yeah, delete.
Furthermore, anybody who has waited this long can start thinking, do I want to just focus on iPhone OS 4 and use all of the benefits of the latest APIs? We don't have to go through all the hoops that other developers have had to go through with less mature APIs. So there's definitely a trade-off. We have not had the opportunity to influence the sort of state of the art on the device. But, you know, there's no shortage of that. There's been lots of great developers out there who have been doing that and kind of showing us how it can be done. So I don't really feel like those of us who are on the sidelines have been are worthy of, as Michael expresses, worry. I don't think there's anything to worry about. I think that those of us who are passionate about the touch platform will show up eventually, and we will have probably better apps because of waiting than if we would have come out from the start.
It's funny, you can read his question in a couple of ways too, because when make it better, I originally interpret that as, you know, be involved in the community and also, you know, complain and send feedback to Apple when they've done something wrong to make the platform better. Because to me, the biggest roadblock to the platform is the App Store and the policies that are sort of around that and are not clear. The reason that Rogue Amoeba doesn't want to play, you know, and put everything into the iPhone and iPad just because it's so uncertain. You know, you don't know if you're getting rejected, if you're on the wrong side of what Apple wants you to do.
Right.
And I feel like Mac people have actually been more vocal than anyone else on this, because we're used to this more open platform where, you know, I don't need anyone's permission to build an app. And for a while, this was like a big problem for me. I didn't, you know, we've talked on this show and I've written a few blog posts about like, this is not going to work. I don't want to risk everything building iPhone apps. It's just too risky as a one person, you know, indie shop where if I invest 2 or 3 months in something and nothing happens, that was completely wasted time. I can't afford to do that. But with the iPad, I think it changes just because it's such a significant step forward in terms of computing. I really want to be involved in it. I'm willing to accept and sort of overlook some things. But getting back to his question, I wish more iPhone developers were a little more vocal in what is not good about the platform. And I don't think Apple, like all the advances they have made with the App Store and the platform, I don't think they just do that out of the kindness of the heart. I mean, I love Apple, but I think it's the people complaining and high profile bloggers and news sites writing about that forces Apple to make changes. And I see a lot of iPhone developers, they're a little bit scared, nervous to complain too loudly because that's their livelihood now, right? They don't want to get on Apple's bad side and then Apple won't feature them in the App Store. And
that's a good point. Kind of, yeah, maybe it's easier and less sort of risky to complain from the sidelines.
Definitely less risky. I hope that I will still complain because I like complaining about the App Store, even when my business sort of depends on those sales.
Right.
But also that brings up something else that I find kind of interesting, the split between apps that are sort of, they need to be in the top 100 to be successful. And then other apps that maybe don't. And my app, I've decided, is in that later category of it doesn't need to be number one for it to be a success for me. I want to charge a fair price for the iPad app and, you know, find some people that want it and that will pay for it. But as long as it's selling and I can figure out a way to market it, I'm not concerned whether it's in the top, you know, 50 or 100. I'm not looking for that, like that big breakthrough. And I think that gives me some flexibility to not fall into the some of the traps that the iPhone and the App Store environment sort of encourage. Yeah. You know, like the prices going up and down, yeah, and, you know, the sort of games people play.
Yeah, the hit mentality is a good way for most people to be disappointed. Like, it's the same thing, mm-hmm, with music. It's the same thing with movies. If your definition of success is to be the big hit, then you're really likely to be disappointed. And you know, that's the same attitude that I have on the Mac. I mean, 99% of Mac users don't know a thing about me or my products, you know? Mm-hmm. And sure, I'd like to dig into that. I'd like to eat into that percentage of people who don't know me and who aren't buying my products. But I can be realistic, you know, for me, like the biggest success of my life would be if I could get 5% of those users to know who I am, you know, like, the hit mentality is, really important if being famous is what you're after. But if, like, being sustained to work on what you loved working on is what you're after, then it's a completely different equation. And it's more like what you're saying. Just try to find a number of people who will pay you a price that makes you able to survive and keep putting software out there.
Yep. I hope that's possible in the App Store. I really do, because I like the consistency on the Mac, where day to day, week to week, sales are kind of consistent until you get a big bump from news or something.
I'm optimistic because, to be honest with you, I believe that it's inevitable we will see demos. We'll see trials.
Yeah.
I have to think so.
Yeah, it'd be nice.
Here's what I think. I think that Apple's got a list of priorities, and providing trials is somewhere on that list, and it just has to bubble its way up to the top.
Mm-hmm.
Apple's got plenty of things to work on. For whatever reason, that hasn't been their priority. They've made little concessions, like allowing a free app to be upgraded, you know, with an in-app purchase.
Right.
I believe that eventually it might even be Apple's own apps that motivate them to provide this service, because they're gonna have some fancy apps in that store. You know, eventually, let's assume that. You know, the touch platform is going to be huge going forward and is going to take a substantial portion of the desktop market. What about when Apple wants to sell Logic for the iPad? You know, what about when they get to the hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars apps? Maybe they'll go the same route if they do it by example and make, you know, Logic free, and you pay an in-app upgrade to, you know, of $500 or whatever, then maybe I'll eat my words and I'll take back my optimism. But right now I think that it's just something, it hasn't become the priority of the day. But one day that will happen and we will all rejoice and we'll find something, you know, the next thing on our list to complain about. It's just like Apple. They have their list, mm-hmm, of prioritized list of things to complain about. Things to fix, and we have our prioritized list of things to complain about. You pop one thing off the list,
yep,
and suddenly we're all, you know, outraged about the next thing down.
The next one, yeah.
So it's just kind of this funny game going on, and I think one day we will be able to charge easily, say, you know, $30, even $100, even $500 for software on the touch platforms, because we'll be able to give demos, you know, that are true demos that show everything the app can do, and prove the case to the user that they should spend that amount of money.
Yep.
You know, talking about this, it's probably worth mentioning this recent policy announcement from Omni Group. Did you see this? They announced that their 30-day money back guarantee applies to App Store purchases as well. And that's profound because, for listeners who don't know, an App Store refund costs the software developer money, because the split goes 70% to the developer, 30% to Apple. And when you refund that money, you only refund your 70%. So the customer gets all. How does this work?
So I think they haven't specifically said how they're going to do it, but I got the impression that they're going to offer the refund directly.
Right. Oh, that's right. Customer. Because you can't refund through this through the App Store. So if you want to refund, you have to do it on your own. Meaning you would.
Yeah. So they eat that 30% every time they refund, right. Which is for OmniGraffle $50. 30%. That's a lot of money to spend.
Yep. So you can bet people like Omni want to have trial periods come to the touch platforms.
Yep.
Anyway, that's interesting. You know what, Manton? I tried something. I don't know if you noticed this, but I tried something real time. I put out another tweet reminding people that we're recording right now.
Yeah.
And I invited them to send any last minute questions to us at our Twitter account at CoreInt. And lo and behold, we have a couple new results.
Awesome.
So maybe we should at least answer one of those so we follow through on our engagement here.
Let's pick some. Yeah.
Should we tackle this? I don't know too much about this. I'll mention this one and see if you know much about it, Manton.
Okay.
John Fabricius says, any thoughts on the lack of VGA out mirroring by default and how devs should take that into consideration? Does this mean that you can't, I'm assuming this means you can't just mirror the entire live screen of your iPad as you're using it. You have to software has to go into a special mirroring mode where they put specific content onto the mirrored display. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding as well. I haven't played with this yet. I have the VGA cable and I haven't even bothered to take it out of its wrapper yet because I haven't had a need, but there's definitely a new API in 3.2 where you can say, an external screen is available and I want to do something different on that one, which is great for Keynote, I guess great for playing video. I'm to be honest, I don't know in my app if I would need to take advantage of that, but I think implied in the question maybe is that maybe all developers should be using that even if they don't have a specific sort of special thing they can do. Maybe they should detect that and mirror or provide the option just in case the user wants to have control over that output.
Right. I guess you have to kind of think carefully about what is the value of a mirrored content for your app.
Mm-hmm.
Like I could see, for instance, let's say theoretically, if I do a crossword app for the iPad, then, I could see you're solving it on the pad, let's say. What do you show on the screen for whose amusement? Is it maybe a competitive mode where you've got five people solving the same puzzle and maybe the VGA out just shows the completed puzzle.
Oh yeah.
And then, on the iPad itself, you see all the clues along with the puzzle. And,
mm-hmm.
and as you pass the iPad between players, you're looking at the clues, but you can always kind of see up on the screen how the puzzle's filling in.
Yeah, stuff like that would be great. I think for a lot of games, I can imagine a chess tournament or something where people are watching what's going on. That would be really compelling to me. And maybe this is the kind of feature where, it's kind of like AppleScript on the Mac, where it's not something that anyone necessarily buys the app for or knows it's even there, but when they need it, they're happily surprised that, oh, look how scriptable the app is.
Right, right.
On the iPad, the same kind of thing. They don't know about this, but then they plug in oh, look how nice this output is. It's perfect for...
Right. Even if you didn't have anything useful, it might be a clever and fun trick just to put a cute little note in the mirror display saying nothing to see here. Sorry, I don't have anything useful to put here.
Right.
Just to let the customer have that kind of communication. Oh, they thought of this.
Mm-hmm.
They thought I might try to plug it in.
That's a good. I like this thought a lot, and I think I'm going to make a note to try to do something with that.
Right.
Should we take a couple more questions?
Sure. This might be a little extra long to make up for our absence, but I'm okay with that. I think this is our special iPad. All iPad, all the time, commentary and Q&A episode. And if you've gotten bored, listeners, you can always come back next week if we record again.
So next week. This is not a weekly show. What are you talking about? So Ryan Farnell says, what have your iPad usage habits been like so far? Using it more than your laptop, desktop, or in combination. I think we've already talked about that a little bit, how we're personally using it so far. And I'm sure that will evolve as more apps come out and we're more used to typing on the device.
Well, one thing I'm curious about, Manton, I don't know if you mentioned this yet, but I said that I use it mostly in my living room. And what has happened so far for me has, my prediction has come true that I have not taken it out of my house hardly at all. It went to mm-hmm. a cafe near my house once because a friend of mine in the cafe saw me on Twitter and said, "Will you please bring that over here so I can see it?" Partly I think because it's awkward, it's big. I can't put it in my pocket. I have to have a case or a backpack or something, and then I have to keep track of that. I don't want to lose it. It's not really an everywhere device for me. So it would have to be like a very specific, like, oh, I'm going to the, I thought about it once, like I'm going to the park with my kid. Maybe I'll bring it and use it while he's, running around on the playground. But then I don't have the 3G one, obviously. Nobody does yet. And it's like, oh, here I am at the park with no internet access. What am I going to do with my iPad?
Yeah, I think the 3G is going to change that a little bit. I've taken it out of the house a few times, and it's always been kind of awkward. And to be honest, the only reason I took it out, well, one time was kind of like you said, a friend was at a coffee shop, and we're like, I really want to check it out, because he was a big Kindle user and hadn't gotten the iPad yet and wanted to kind of play with it and see what it was like for ebooks. But the other problem I've run into is getting back to how I said I'm exclusively doing Twitter on the iPad with Twitterific, I would say 95% of the time. And in fact, right now when I'm reading this stuff from at Corrent, I'm using the iPad right now to do that. But I ran into this trap where, like, I'm going to work at the coffee shop for a few hours. I have to take the iPad with me because I'm doing all my Twitter stuff on it. I don't have to. I could use the web, or I could use the phone, or I could...
If you want to stick to your guns for the experiment.
Right. But it has been kind of awkward, and I think there's two reasons for me. One is Wi-Fi. You got to make sure you're somewhere that has Wi-Fi. Otherwise, the device is kind of useless for what I'm using it for. And the other thing is just I'm not over that stage of, ooh, I was the first to buy an iPad. Look how special I am,
I see that a lot on Twitter, too. A lot of people are self-conscious about the...
Yeah.
It's true. I mean, you don't want to be that guy who's like, well, aren't I special? And it's also like, it's a combination of being that guy and also being like, if you live in an urban environment, at least, it's like you feel a little more of a target. Like, you don't want to whip this thing out on a subway and be like,
yeah.
It's like I remember when the iPods first came out, and remember, actually, this was a big thing. Like, police departments around the country were putting up signs like, don't use your white earphones because they are obvious to thieves that you have an iPod.
Yeah.
Like, imagine. Right.
I remember that. Now everyone has an iPod, so it's kind of...
Right. So eventually, if things work out the way that we hope, it won't be like the weirdest thing in the world to have an iPad, and maybe we'll get more casual in how we use them.
Yep. What I'm hoping is that I can go to a coffee shop or something with just the iPad, and I can do real work for a couple hours. I would like to get to that point, because I especially felt weird. I think I would feel less weird going out with just the iPad than going out with my MacBook and my iPad, because I set up at the coffee shop, I've got my latte, I've got my MacBook up, and then I've got an iPad next to it. It just feels like completely over the top. Like, why do I need these?
It makes
two
you look like even more of
sitting
a
here.
Major doof, right?
Yeah, it's like a complete luxury that no one in their right mind would need. And
well, I want to mention one concrete improvement in my life because of the iPad so far is in the realm of content consumption. It's thanks to Instapaper.
Oh yeah.
I have definitely been whittling down my aspirational "I want to read this someday" list, and that's because I can't get distracted in Xcode doing work. I can't, the solitary task, single app focus of the iPad makes me more likely to stick to one app. So I get into Instapaper. I got my list of things I've long ago added and said I want to read this someday, And I just start cranking through it, you know, sitting on the couch, sitting on the floor. Again, it's often when my kid's distracted with something. He doesn't even want to play with me. And I'm sitting there, have to hang out. I got my iPad now and I'm reading through stuff that, you know, frankly, I did not do a good job of catching up on stuff I wanted to read. long blog posts, long documentation, things that, you know, technical analyses. That's kind of whittling away now. I'm going to be at a point soon where I'm going to be like Instapaper zero, and I'm going to have to go actively searching out new reading material. And that is totally new to me, totally thanks to the iPad.
Yeah, I got into Instapaper a little bit late, maybe 6 months ago. I started using it on the iPhone, and it totally changed how I get distracted and read things. Anything longer than a few sentences or a paragraph, I will throw to Instapaper and read later. And the iPad, that was one of the first apps I tried on the iPad, and it was just, especially since I was used to doing it on the iPhone, and then all of a sudden you got this big screen, the text looks amazing. Total game changer app. I mean, I swear by that app.
Yeah.
It totally improves for the better, like in a real significant way, how you get work done away from the computer.
And it's like Netflix for free content on the web, you know? It's just like queues it up. I'm browsing my queue. It's just like feels good. It's like a to-do list with content.
Yep. It's great. All right, let's do a couple quick more. Another one just came in from Alex Rosenberg.
Uh-huh.
Why do iPads keyboard layout suck so much? What's that big undo button for anyway? Where's the emoji and T9 for Japanese? Oh my goodness. I'm thankful for the undo button. It's kind of weird that it's there on the keyboard, but definitely the shake to undo thing I think was a mistake. That's the one thing that I can point to with the iPhone that was not a good idea. It's impossible to discover. And undo is important. I mean, you make mistakes, and you need to be able to undo things, especially in word processors or whatever. And shaking the phone was weird enough. Shaking the iPad is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I don't know why it's on the keyboard. Maybe it should be in-app. Maybe every app should have their own undo button. I don't know. But
it's weird. It's definitely weird for it to be there, but it is a challenge for the Apple designers how to handle that. I think the keyboard does have problems. I mean, I mentioned earlier that it doesn't seem to line up right with how I want to type. Also, there's this like collapse button in the lower right corner. You know, the button that basically says I want to close the keyboard.
Right.
And partly this is because I'm informed by, you know, the age old visual, you know, idiom of a downward facing triangle meaning pop up menu. But I click that like thinking, oh, maybe there's options here for, you know, how to configure the keyboard, or I don't know. I'm thinking like, what is this? Maybe like auto completion options. I don't know. And of course it throws away what I was, you know, my keyboard. And sometimes in some apps that means like throw away what I was typing. So I think there's some, I won't be surprised if we see some iterations on the keyboard for usability.
Yep.
And that undo button does seem a little weird. I don't know how they sort of get that in better, but maybe like I could see, for instance, for undo, maybe like touch and hold on the delete button. I mean, it's part of the problem is what you said before, it was too non-obvious how you undo, and so you don't want to make it too non-obvious again. But it does seem kind of weird to me to have a whole button in the midst of a bunch of letters and stuff that means undo. It seems like a weird place for a verb. You know, there aren't a lot of verbs on the keyboard, right?
Right. It doesn't fit. He's right. It does. Like, it's got to be somewhere, but it doesn't really belong with the A key and the other things. Related though, the no tab key on the keyboard is something that hit me. So there's some apps that you can't tab, which is kind of, it seems like a big problem to me. I was editing something in a web browser, in a text area on a web browser, and I wanted to tab and I couldn't. There was just no way. And so I went into Pages, like, well, how do they solve that? And actually in Pages, in the toolbar, they have a little tab button. like in the app, right? They built it themselves. So that's kind of a similar thing. It's like that feels like it should be on the keyboard, but it's not. And so each app has to sort of roll their own.
Yeah.
If they need that functionality.
I think on the iPad, especially, it would be sort of a possibly dangerous concession, but maybe a necessary concession in the long run to allow for an extreme amount of customization in the keyboard. You know, like I ran into trouble in on the iPhone trying to sort of come up with the best way of using the keyboard for crosswords. And I know that my friendly competitors over at they do the app Crosswords for the iPhone. They ran into the same problem and ended up having to implement their own keyboard from scratch. So I just think like this, the keyboard is such an important part of the interface. It's the only sort of like long form input method for the phone and for the iPad. At some point, I think there has to be a concession that just says, you know, some people are going to have really customized keyboards. You know, I don't know how they solve that. Obviously, that just puts the usability problem on every app. But it seems like some apps, at least, would be able to cleverly come up with a more usable experience with a little more control over that keyboard.
Let's actually, I want to close out with one question that we skipped, which I thought was good. Sort of big picture thing, which is from Paul Crawford. He asks, how do you think the iPad is going to impact the Mac software market? We sort of touched on that, but not directly. And I don't know, do you have any thoughts on that other than what we've already talked about? I mean, when I read that question, I think pricing,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
All Mac apps eventually going to be 99 cents or they won't be able to compete. And I don't think that's true. I certainly hope that doesn't go that way.
No, I don't think so. And especially look at it this way. The desktop pricing model is supported not just by the Mac itself, but it's supported by Windows and what people charge for software on Windows. It's supported by, you know, companies like Adobe going to suddenly drop their prices to $9.99. I don't think so. That their entire livelihood is based on, frankly, an overpriced software, but here's what I think. Here's my optimistic take on this. The Mac has a software market, and it's the viability of that market is directly related to the number of Mac users. There's some people who might assume that the iPad is going to eat into the number of Mac users eventually. I think it's possible eventually. It's worth remembering that in the short term, you need a desktop computer to sync and update and manage your iPad. That can be a Mac or a PC right now. I think this is what we've witnessed over the past 10 years. We had this Mac market. It got bigger with the iMac because the iMac was awesome, brought more people to the platform. Then the iPod happened. That brought more people to the Mac platform because people saw how great the iPod was. The iPhone happened, did more of the same, right? There's more and more people coming over to the Mac. Mac versus PC TV ads bring more and more people. So the market on the Mac is just getting bigger and bigger. Now, what happens when the iPad comes out? I think it's just going to be more of the same. The iPad is definitely going to sell to people who are currently using PCs. They're going to use their PCs to manage that iPad. And look at it this way. The more the iPad does legitimately take away reliance for a particular need on the desktop, the more portable that user becomes. So, you know, let's say that the iPad takes away email from the desktop, takes away web browsing from the desktop, and suddenly this user is completely charmed by the iPad. They still have a need for a desktop computer for some things, but they're all that much more likely now to go buy a Mac because they love the iPad, they love the iPod, they love the iPhone, and suddenly they love everything that Apple does, and they might as well round that out with a Mac. I think as long as desktop computers remain viable, and I think that's a long time, the Mac is stronger than ever now because of the iPod, the iPad. So that's my optimistic take on it. I think it's going to be more growth in the Mac software market. And as I said, a few years ago, Manton, on our last podcast episode, it's an awesome time to be programming for the Mac because everybody's a little bit distracted right now. and they're working on trying to balance how to work on the iPad and phone and Mac at the same time. But this market, I think, is ripe. It's still, there's still going to be a lot of sales. And right now, if you're making Mac software, it's a really good opportunity.
Well, let's ship some Mac apps, maybe some iPad apps later. And thanks, everyone, for your questions. We missed a couple, I think, but we got to some good ones. So that I think that worked out pretty well. Maybe we'll try that again.
Yeah, that was pretty fun.
So thanks again, everyone, for listening to the sort of extra long iPad edition of Core Intuition. And we'll see you next time.
See you next time.